This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetSurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Later this week, astronaut Scott Kelly will be heading to the International Space Station for a year-long mission aimed at studying the physiological effects of prolonged spaceflight. Critical to the study is Scott's twin brother, Mark Kelly, a retired astronaut who will participate by staying here on Earth as a sort of controlled variable. Mark Kelly also has a new book out called Astro Twins, a fictional chapter book for young readers based on the twins' formative years. And Mark, it's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
Before we get started, sure, we're going to be seeing a lot more images of you and your brother. So let's just get this straight. You are the brother with the mustache. Am I correct?
I am.
I guess you better keep that mustache.
Well, maybe, maybe not. We'll have to see. It was one way for people to tell us apart for 15 years when we had the same exact job.
So what does NASA hope to understand by studying you and your brother during his year-long stay in space?
That's a good question. You know, if we're going to send people out one day to go to Mars and live there for a period of time and then bring them back, it's a very unforgiving environment. And we have data on a lot of people in space at the space station, a lot of Americans that have spent up to 6 months into space, maybe a little bit longer than that, including my brother several years ago when he did a long-duration mission. But beyond that, we don't have any data on anybody. And a trip to Mars, it's going to take 2 to 3 years. And it's one of the bigger challenges in sending people to Mars. It's human physiology. And how does this unforgiving space environment affect the human condition?
I'm thinking zero gravity, that is a big factor in muscle deterioration, apparently. What are some of the other specific things that break down in the body under those kind of conditions?
It's a good question. You know, we have muscle and bone loss in the absence of gravity. There's some things we can do to mitigate against that, like using this weightlifting machine we have on the space station or running on the treadmill. The absence of gravity, and we're not so sure why, but it also depresses the immune systems of astronauts. So their immune systems get very depressed while in space, and that could be a challenge if you had some virus or bacteria that got introduced into that environment. We've also seen in long-duration crew members a significant change in their vision, and that's because something happens to the optic nerve of astronauts when they stay in space for a long time.
Really?
We're not so sure why. Huh. So we're concerned, like, if we send somebody to live on Mars or send somebody there for a trip, you know, there and back, maybe by the time they get to Mars, they have serious vision issues. So there's that and other things. I mean, one of the big problems is the radiation. It's a significant radiation dose to do a trip to Mars. So there's going to be a lot of the experiments on my brother and I have to do with how the radiation affects our genetic material.
Hmm. So he is going to be there at the International Space Station. You're going to be here on Earth. His body will be going through these experiences and challenges. How often will you be going in for monitoring or for checkups, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so far I made trips to Houston on 2 different occasions to give blood and do MRIs of my brain and my heart and my carotid artery and my optic nerve, a bunch of ultrasounds, some other testing as well. And I've done that twice. I was also on a trip to New York once where NASA sent somebody over to get about 20 tubes of blood from me in the hotel. I think my next trip to the Johnson Space Center for these studies will be in September while he's in space. And I'll do that a couple times, and then there'll be follow-up testing after he gets back. So it's not it's not too intrusive from my personal point of view.
Hmm. How about as a baseline, did you and your brother have to get into as close as possible physical shape before the mission?
No, but we're pretty similar. I'm not going to be eating the same thing he is in space. That would be a difficult thing to do, you know, that you'd have to pass over the pizza when you had the opportunity. But I remember 10 years ago, probably, when after one of my NASA flight physicals that we do yearly, that one of the doctors pulled out my brother's record and was just amazed, you know, how closely all of our levels and numbers for all different kinds of things were. It almost seemed like it was the same person. So we're pretty similar in a lot of regards.
That's so interesting. And I guess that's what makes you the perfect candidates for this kind of a comparative mission.
Yeah, the perfect guinea pigs. Right.
I'm speaking with retired astronaut Mark Kelly. Later this week, his twin brother, Scott, is going to be heading up to the International Space Station for a one-year mission to study the long-term effects of spaceflight. Lately, Mark has been writing children's books and spending time with his wife, who is the former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords. Do you ever find yourself wishing, Mark, that the roles were reversed for this mission, that you would be going to space and he would be staying on Earth? Or would that be really hard for you to be away from your wife, Gabrielle Giffords,
that long? Well, it would be. Yeah, it would be hard to be away for that period of time. That's one of the reasons I left NASA in 2011, is that I didn't see myself doing a long-duration flight after what happened to Gabby in January of 2011, mm-hmm. being shot there at the Safeway supermarket. So I kind of moved on from that. But I'd be lying to say, you know, I wasn't a little bit envious that he's getting to go into space one more time. And you never know. Maybe I'll kind of give him a little bump out of the way and I'll jump into his suit.
How long do you think it would take for someone to notice?
I don't know. You know, that's good. I'd have to shave off my mustache, but then, you know, you never know.
Now, you have talked recently about possibly running for office. Your wife, of course, and we'll say again, former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. Wouldn't it be a little tough to start building a campaign while you're tethered, so to speak, to NASA?
Well, I'm not tethered too tightly to NASA, but I also find it interesting that, you know, that statement I made during an interview was really taken that I'm contemplating running for office.
What was the statement then?
Well, I mean, I was asked, would I ever consider running for political office? And I think I said something to the effect of that I'm not planning on it. But, you know, under the right circumstances, you know, maybe I would consider it. And I'm not one to ever say, you know, absolutely not to anything. So that was my answer. And people took that as, like, me planning.
That something. Counts as yes in the eyes.
That counts as yes. To me, that sounds like no.
Well, we've heard so many people say, oh, no, I'm not really sure about it. You know, look, you're an astronaut. You're the husband of an absolutely beloved former congresswoman. Maybe people just hope you are.
Yeah, maybe. It's a tough job. You know, I watched Gabby do that job 24 hours a day. And you know, it's I like what we're doing now. We're involved in a lot of different things. I get to spend a lot more time with my wife than I ever did before, which is important to me. So it's not something at the top of my wish list.
Mm. Well, you spoke earlier about how you and your brother were physiologically so alike. And a lot of twins do talk about having a special spiritual, if you will, or some cognitive connection with their siblings. Does that connection feel different for you at all when your brother is in space?
You know, it's interesting that when he's in space, I actually talk to him more often. Hmm. You know, because he's pretty far away and isolated, and he's got a phone and email. So I think we tend to communicate even a little bit more when he's in space on a long-duration flight than we do normally. Hmm. So maybe in a way we have a little bit better of a connection.
Well, of course, you and your brother are crucial to this study, and you're both big proponents of science education. And on that note, I understand that you have a new book out. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, it's a book called Astro Twins. It's a book about my brother and I growing up, mm-hmm. how we enlist some of our friends to build a rocket ship, and one of us goes up into space. It's obviously fictional. It's for young readers between the ages of, oh, I don't know, maybe 8 and 12 years old. It's a chapter book. I put a lot of you know, concepts in the book about, you know, some about physics and math to try to keep the reader of the book, you know, not only interested in the story, but maybe get them a little bit more interested in STEM, you know, science, technology, engineering, and math. So we're pretty excited about it. I've written books before for the really young kids, the picture books, and now this is a novel for young kids, you know, that are reading complete books. And I think it's an exciting story that kids will be really interested in, and it's called Astro Twins.
Mark Kelly, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome, Virginia. Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate your time. Mark Kelly, former astronaut who is not running for office. He's author of the new book, Astro Twins. You can learn more about his book and about the study the twins are taking part in, about the physiological effects of long-term spaceflight. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Spending a year in space is not an easy undertaking, which is why, before we hear this contrary opinion, we want to emphasize that what Mark and Scott Kelly are doing is really, really incredible.
We love what NASA's doing. Like almost everyone, I think, in the nation, Scientific American, we're huge fans of NASA. And in this case, NASA is trying to use the International Space Station as a research platform. It's been underutilized as a research platform in the past. It's good they're using it more.
Lee Billings there, an editor covering space and physics at Scientific American. Despite his praise for the project, he's a little dubious of NASA's twin study.
If we know how to fix the problem, rather than just studying it, shouldn't we be doing that?
Basically, Lee says we already know space is harmful. Scott Kelly's year-long stay will provide us with more details. But microgravity and cosmic radiation, space travelers have been dealing with these problems for years. So if NASA really wants to get humans to Mars, we don't need more details about just how bad it is. We need to come up with long-term solutions. And Lee says we already know what some of them are.
Back in 1903, actually, there was a Russian named Konstantin Tsiolkovsky who talked about a possible way to combat this microgravity. And essentially, all you have to do is you just have to rotate your spacecraft, and you'll get a centripetal force that's along the outside of it. So you can imagine a scenario where you could spin a spacecraft to get either a fraction of Earth gravity or even full Earth gravity. And then you don't have to worry about microgravity as much.
So this is basically the same concept that we saw in the movie Interstellar, right?
That's our producer, Taylor Quimby, talking with Lee.
Yeah, it's in Interstellar. It's in 2001, A Space Odyssey. What always happens in these sorts of Hollywood films is they will bring in some advisor from outside, some technical advisor, and almost always the technical advisor will say, well, you know, you want to send your crew to Mars or to slingshot around the sun or to another star or to Jupiter, wherever you want to go, you're going to have to spin the spacecraft.
The issue, of course, is money. It would cost lots and lots of money to research, test, and eventually build a rotating spacecraft. And NASA did once have plans to start testing its viability.
There was actually a module that was slated to go up for the ISS, as we call it, called the Centrifuge Accommodations Module, a small centrifuge that you could use to test varying levels of gravity, artificial gravity. On biological samples, so like, you know, mice or water bears, small creatures.
But that module was canceled in 2005 for budgetary reasons.
I guess in science fiction movies, the space programs always get a bigger budget.
Yes, they do.
So to be clear, Lee absolutely gets why NASA is spending more time researching the effects of space than coming up with a solution. Basically, they're just working with what they have.
MEQ, initiate data logger.
And meanwhile, the agency is operating the Hubble telescope.
Roger.
Building the James Webb telescope.
Roger.
Running the International Space Station.
T-minus 1 minute. 47.
Investing in contracts with groups like SpaceX.
T-minus 1 minute.
Working on lots of other missions, like the Mars rover Curiosity.
And liftoff. At dawn.
The problem with researching the health effects of space, Lee says, is partly a philosophical one. When do you stop?
At what point is it good enough? At what point will we have enough information to say that astronauts can be sent safely to these various destinations.
Whatever the case, we all wish Scott Kelly and cosmonaut Mikhail Konienko the best of luck on their year-long orbit. What they are doing is invaluable and incredibly brave. Lee just hopes that someday NASA gets the funding to take this kind of research to the next level, to transcend the information gathering and move toward a solution. And to be honest, he also wishes Mark Kelly and Scott Kelly were eating the same foods for the next year.
Are they not actually eating the same foods?
Oh, no.
Oh, man, really?
Yeah.
See, there's stuff like that. I mean, I guess maybe they just can't control for everything, but it's like, come on. Well, come on, because one thing they're doing is they're studying the microbiome. They're studying their poop.
Yeah.
So it's like you're going to be eating different things, and then you're going to hope to get some useful data from their poop by comparing it. Like, that's not doesn't work that way, pal.
I know.
You know, like, what is this, rocket science?
Lee Billings, an editor at Scientific American, where he covers physics and space. You can check out Scientific American's commentary on NASA's year-long mission. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Have you ever fantasized about living on a lush tropical island? Would you settle for a long, cold winter on a rugged rock 6 miles off the coast of Portsmouth? For the last 18 years, photographer Alexandra De Steiger has done just that as the lone winter caretaker of Star Island. NHPR's Sean Hurley paid her a visit and sent us the story.
On our first attempt to leave the harbor for Star Island, the muffler was frozen, and the Miss Julie, a 29-foot lobster boat, wouldn't start. On our second try, the impeller broke and the engine overheated. Sailors are superstitious, and if anything goes wrong this time, Brad Anderson jokes, he might have to toss me overboard.
You might be bad luck.
Is it me?
It might be you.
Anderson makes surfboards in York, Maine. He's also the land-based half of Star Island's winter caretaking team. Every few weeks, he makes this 9-mile journey to visit his partner, Alexandra De Steiger.
Bring supplies, water, food. Fundamentally, she's out there by herself most of the time.
Anderson and De Steiger first met as tall ship crewmates. And Anderson recalls even then, she was taking pictures of the sea.
She's been a photographer for 28 years probably, but she didn't really do much on the business side of art to actually get seen more and get people to know her work.
De Steiger's reticence and preference for solitude meant that her art went largely unseen for years. But after self-publishing Small Island, Big Picture, a collection of her photographs in 2013, the world got its first real glimpse of her work.
You know, at some point, someone's going to notice and realize how remarkable what she's doing is.
The book led to shows in Portsmouth, Representation, and in Boston this summer, a show at the Pucker Gallery.
It's kind of been a big year for her.
Around us, the sharp water crackles with light, and the snow-white islands seem to rise from the waves. De Steiger meets me on the ice-clad dock, in a green army jacket and blue jeans, and leads me over the snow to her caretaker's house.
It's got everything for me. It's got surrounded by the sea. It's rocky and rugged. I feel like I'm a northern girl. You know, I need to feel like I'm suffering somewhat. I just feel more alive that way.
She outlines the significant chapters of her life. First, as a girl wandering through the swamp beside her house.
I remember some days I would, like, the project for the day would be to pack a lunch and head out and try to get lost. That would be my, you know, big hope.
As she grew older, she wanted to get lost in something vaster.
I just had this big romance with the sea, and I always wanted to sail on a ship.
When she turned 18, she signed up for a course of study on a tall ship. She met Brad Anderson, and for the next 9 years, they were sailors.
Do you think you would have come to photography if you hadn't, you know, gone to sea?
I don't know if I would have found my grand passion, the thing that I needed to express, if I didn't go to sea.
De Steiger took the winter caretaking job 18 years ago. While daily chores occupy some of her time, clearing snow and checking the 20 or so buildings, she spends most of the day doing what she likes.
I call it mooning. You know, I just moon about. Someone once asked me, well, you know, aren't you out there taking pictures all the time? I said, no, you know, I really need to just, you know, moon around. I need to sit for long periods of time and, you know, let my mind clear and and just absorb the scene.
But when she finally does see something, the camera comes out.
I think for me, it's the scene itself that is important to me. And then with the photograph that I make of it, I only hope that I can do that justice.
So you're seeing it first with your eye?
Yeah. In my heart. If you have the great arch of the sky, you know, over a thing, you can see how small that thing is. And that's sort of one of my themes is I like that feeling of, you know, being tiny and feeling, you know, minuscule.
The more solitude, the greater the sky seems and the smaller she gets.
If I could have solitude and be with Brad at the same time, that's how I would improve it. But you can't, I could have one or the other.
With her naked eye, from her kitchen, De Steiger can see the mountain in Farmington, where she lives the rest of the year in a solar-powered cabin.
I'm a person I don't like as well on the mainland. But out here, it's almost like out here is when, you know, I'm a glass of water and I'm just filled right up. And then on the mainland, I spill it all out.
We go for a walk around the island, and I ask her if she's ever met anyone who needed as much solitude as she does.
My dad. He built a house on a mountain in Costa Rica. And his parents, actually, I just learned this. His parents moved to the desert and they built this little house and out in the middle of nowhere. And that's where my dad grew up. And so I guess it runs in the family.
We hear the sound of Miss Julie's engine rumble to life. And we head for the boat and say our goodbyes and begin to watch each other disappear.
You wouldn't think that you could become more connected to the world you live in by being isolated on an island. But in fact, that's what happens.
De Steiger, a little dash now against the snow, gets smaller and smaller, alone once again on her island. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
Coming up, whether it's Mario jumping on a turtle or the more graphic violence of games like Call of Duty, killing serves a pivotal function in most video games. We're going to find out why when Word of Mouth continues after a short break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Even people who don't play video games know that they involve a lot of killing. In fact, that may be all they know. From the Super Mario Brothers blithely squashing heads as they jump across the screen to the cascades of blood left in the wake of Mortal Kombat or Call of Duty, the kill-or-be-killed strategy is central to gameplay. Killscreen founder and PBS game show video host Jamin Warren takes up the question of why so much blood gets shed in gaming. And Jamin, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Hello, how are you doing?
Very well. Interesting question to ask here. Could anybody argue that killing is not prevalent in gaming?
Well, I mean, I think one of the most important things to remember about any activity that you perform in video games is that at some level, it was rooted in abstraction. So a game like chess, you know, when it was developed, it rooted out of this Indian game called Chaturanga, which is a game that, you know, military generals would use to sort of simulate warfare. You know, that had a lot of violence in abstraction. And I'm sure if you gave the creator of chess the ability to create something that was more bloody or violent, they probably would have. But we don't necessarily think of chess as a game as being particularly violent, even though that's what it's simulating. So I think one of the enduring legacies of games has a lot to do with the connection between competition, which is a very popular form of gameplay, and violence. And you see that in lots of places outside of games. Rugby, for example, is a game that young cadets would play as a way, again, military training. This idea of football in its earliest days was, you know, beloved by Teddy Roosevelt because of its martial style. So it's interesting because games operate on these two different levels, both as an abstraction, but can also have sort of like a narrative element tied to it. So.
Well, you're talking about a long history of getting people amped up, you know, to play games in competition. Any more in electronic games than in other media, for example?
That's a great question. You know, in some ways, games are not, you know, they're a reflection of the times in which they are created. And so if you look at other, you know, if you look at other media, there's certainly, you know, a lot of violence in other places. You know, Shakespeare's Titus Andronicus, for example, a lot of the gruesomeness of the Greek tragedies. Even, you know, something like Cinderella, you know, which is coming back to theaters, you know, the original Cinderella, you know, the Grimm's fairy tales were all incredibly violent. You know, people being thrown into ovens and being cut open. And so in some ways, you know, games are just part of this longer lineage of using violence ostensibly in the service of something greater. So, and I think they're just now starting to figure out what's the responsible way to start to think about that, what's the responsible way to use that. But, you know, you can make the same argument that when Shakespeare was putting so many people to death on stage that he was doing it to certainly to titillate and entertain.
Mm. Well, you talked to researchers who looked into the attraction of the kill or be killed nature of games. So what is going on inside of the brains of the game player when they're killing or being killed?
Well, one of the reasons why sort of killing in games is sort of popular is, research that comes from Scott Rigby and Richard Ryan. It's called self-determination theory, and it's a theory that people are motivated to engage in activities in order to satisfy, you know, three basic psychological needs. And one of those needs is, you know, the feeling of competence and power, maintaining autonomy, and feeling important to other people. And game designers often lean on that when they're trying to sort of give players something to do, because game designers, that's what they do. You have to sort of spur the player to action, either against another player or against some simulated character. And, you know, self-determination theory would sort of suggest that, that killing in games sort of meets those three criteria. Certainly you feel powerful. Certainly you are an independent person when you do that. And if you layer the right narrative elements over it, let's say you're rescuing someone, for example, it can make you feel like you're important to other people. But I think one of the important things to remember about violence in games is that when game designers, oftentimes when they employ it as it is an abstraction. It's something that you're sort of doing in the game, and that's why you find it in lots of non-explicit places, like Tetris, for example. You know, the sort of blocks exist or they don't exist.
Right. So give us more examples of that. I mean, the act of killing or dying in a video game can be separated from the notion of violence. So are there killing mechanisms in games that you'd consider non-violent?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, chess was the one I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. Certainly Super Mario Brothers, throughout its long history, you're always kind of eliminating these other characters.
Squashing their heads.
Yeah, exactly, by jumping on their heads.
But they don't look even remotely human, you know, sort of their little mushroom heads or little kind of creatures. So we're separated from this idea that we're killing another being.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point. You know, one of the reasons that game designers often use, like zombies, for example, zombies or aliens or these other creatures, is because it allows them to do the same thing that, you know, Shigeru Miyamoto did with Super Mario Brothers, was, you know, you can sort of kill things that aren't quite human, so it doesn't have the same kind of effect, as opposed to war games, for example, where it's sort of a requirement that you, it's kind of a requirement that, you know, you sort of have to be engaged with other people. But yeah, that's why there are oftentimes these stand-in sort of characters, so that you can sort of use the mechanics of competition and elimination without the sort of quote-unquote human cost attached to it.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to this idea of the narrative. It is a very sort of binary thing, right? There's life and death. There's a very simple black or white. As video games evolve, do you think those gray areas will be explored more?
Yeah, and I think that you certainly have a lot of people who've grown up on video games that are starting to expect a lot more. You know, I don't necessarily think that my sensibilities when I was a teenager were certainly as, you know, honed, or what my expectations were of media are certainly as high as they are now. So I think that is a place that games still are trying to figure out, which is, you know, violence is a part of lots of different media. I mean, you look at all the anti-heroes on television, for example, you know, shows like Breaking Bad or Game of Thrones, for that matter. So there's certainly a place for violence in media. And I think what games are starting to figure out is, like, how do you structure it in a way that actually matches the narrative form? So there are ways in which, you know, some games can use violence as a way to spur the player to do something great or brave or whatever that might be. A great example is, you know, Jack Bauer on the show 24. I mean, if you look at that show, he kills over 300 people over the course of, I guess, seven or eight seasons. And nobody ever thinks of Jack Bauer as being some sort of serial killer, because the narrative there is so strong and captivating, so people are willing to accept that.
Right,
so,
and that's every season is supposed to be a day, so that's
exactly
a lot for a week.
He's killed a lot of people, I mean, a very short period of time. Games are still trying to figure out how to do that. And, the good news is that there are some good examples of, you know, I think game makers are starting to ask some bigger questions about, like, you know, if you give someone a gun, what does that ostensibly mean?
Mm-hmm.
It has to, you know, because I think players get smart and they certainly start to expect a lot more because the bar is so much higher in things outside of games as well.
Damon, can you think of any games that don't have killing at their center that feel like really worthwhile games?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are a lot of like tabletop games, that are in the tradition of games like Ticket to Ride, for example, or Settlers of Catan. Those have, I guess, maybe some of them have more agrarian violence, I suppose, or economic violence. But another good example is a game called Journey, which came out a couple years ago, and that's a cooperative game. There's a game called Gone Home, which is excellent. It's a coming-of-age story set in the early 90s Portland. And there's a game called Kentucky Route Zero, which is like a sort of surrealist, magical adventure game that just came out last year. It kind of takes place in Kentucky, and it centers around this sort of mystical highway that may or may not exist. So,
are those board games or are those video games?
Those are digital games. Mm-hmm. So, and you, if you have like a PC or a Mac, those are all games that you, certainly with Gone Home and Kentucky Route Zero, you don't need a video game console. You can just download those online.
Jamin Warren, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Of course, anytime.
Jamin is founder of the video game arts and culture company Killscreen and host of the PBS Game Slash show. It's really worth looking at the new game show video about this question of why killing is such a big part of video games. You can watch it at wordofmouthradio.org. After the break, we're going to speak with the director of a new documentary about the Jewish delicatessen. We'll celebrate the perfect pastrami sandwich, the fatty miracle that is schmaltz, and investigate the decline of this once American staple. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. What makes a great deli? Well, that depends on who you ask.
Pastrami.
Very lovely chicken fat.
Soups.
The pickles, the peppers, the sauerkraut.
Flanken.
The coleslaw, the potato salad.
The bursting flavor of that incredible juiciness of that hot dog. Oy, it was sexual.
The smell has to hit you the second you open the door, preferably half a block away.
Depends on the guy who runs it. That's the whole key.
If they greet you and there's a personality there, it means a lot.
Deli should be crowded. An empty deli. It's a sad day.
Opinions are plentiful. What is increasingly rare is finding a traditional delicatessen to get a pastrami sandwich or a noodle kugel. They were once tens of thousands in the U.S. Now there are about 150. The origins and demise of this quintessentially American food tradition is the topic of Deli Man, a new documentary playing on Sunday at Red River Theater in Concord, just one of many movies and theaters that are part of the New Hampshire Jewish Film Festival. And the man behind Deli Man is producer and director Eric Greenberg Anjou. Welcome to Word of Mouth.
Good afternoon. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, among the things that we learn in this film is that the deli is not a Jewish tradition, but distinctly American. How did they come to be here in the U.S.?
We spoke with a number of experts, obviously, over the course of making the film. And the interesting thing is this thing that we identify as Jewish deli or American deli is not an American tradition. It didn't even exist in the homeland of some of these countries. It started when the immigrants got here. The very kickoff was with the German non-Jewish immigrants. They started, that was the first incarnation of the delicatessen per se, but everyone, copies one another. It's America. So then Jewish German immigrants began the delicatessens, and little by little, especially towards the end of the century, the 19th century, as the Eastern European immigration influx began and continued, different groups kind of like jumped into the pot, so to speak, and offered their own culinary traditions, own ethnic traditions underneath that the deli rubric.
Well, we learned so much about the deli and the many, many deli owners and operators. Among those we meet is David Ziggy Gruber. He's third generation deli man. Now, he went to this fancy London cooking school and was poised to become a high-end chef, but changed his mind at a very early age. What changed it?
I think that Ziggy has, there were two children in the family. There were Ziggy and his brother Jay. And each one of the brothers kind of fell under the very strong influence of competing sets of grandparents. Ziggy became much, much closer to his, for whatever reasons, to his father's parents that came from an Eastern European tradition. And so they very much influenced him. He was working in the deli since the age of 8. He loved the old-timers. He loved the stories. He loved the Yiddish language. And so this really kind of became part and parcel of his DNA. He decided, you know, as we all do when we grow up, that sometimes that thing that other people tell us we are, we aren't. We have to discover it for ourselves. So Ziggy really wanted to return to his family roots, his family culinary traditions vis-a-vis his paternal grandfather and follow the deli destiny.
He's just a wonderful guy. His brother, in fact, says Ziggy was born an 80-year-old Jew.
Exactly.
But he ends up in Houston, not Houston. Let's just make that clear. When we learn that there is a long tradition of Jewish culture in the South, who knew? I mean, huh?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, we're still, as Americans, we're still an evolving culture in terms of how we welcome or embrace immigrant groups. You know, at a certain point, I think somewhere in the 1920s, I don't have the exact date, but the gates to the Eastern European Jewish populations were closed. And so Jews came to other parts of the country in different ways, in terms of Texas and the Southwest, primarily through Galveston. So there's an absolutely quiet, blossoming, and vibrant Jewish community in the Southwest, all over the South, as a matter of fact. But that's how it happened in Texas.
It's a really tough job running a deli, as we learn. Ziggy himself, he isn't married. He says the deli is his mistress. But it's all, for him, about the food. What is some characteristic deli food for those of us here in New Hampshire who don't get exposed to a whole lot of it?
Delicatessen food, or in this case, Jewish delicatessen food, is really split into two different parts. There's the meat side of the tradition. So there's the corned beef, there's the salami, there's, of course, that succulent, spicy pastrami. But then there's also the other side of the tradition, and that is the kitchen foods. Those are the kugels, the soups, the barley mushroom soups, the matzo ball soups. These came from kind of grandma's kitchen. They evolved over time. Again, they came from different countries, different traditions, but they all became part of the deli tradition. So when you love deli, you can partake of that meat if that's the way you want to go. But then there's also these other lovely, succulent kitchen foods that are really the standards and favorites.
And comfort foods. I used to live in New York City, and I have many a friend, myself included, who would, even if we were ill, would somehow get ourselves to or have delivered chicken in a pot or chicken soup, matzo ball soup from the Second Avenue Deli, which cured every ailment known to man. And at the base of it all is schmaltz. Let's hear just a clip from your film about the unctuous characteristic of schmaltz.
Schmaltz is ultimately what determines Jewish food. Schmaltz means fat. In Yiddish usage, unless you qualify it, it's always assumed to refer to poultry fat. It's the WD-40 of the kosher kitchen. It does everything. It's also the KY of the kosher marriage.
That is just a clip from the film Deli Man, and we're speaking with the film's producer and director, Eric Greenberg Anjou. How do you sell fat? How do you sell blintzes and corned beef sandwiches so big one of your subjects says you have to get a jaw adjustment to eat them? Now, in this age of, you know, the kale salad and the gluten-free diet.
I think everything travels in waves, history certainly, and obviously food history as well. So I think there's been a very self-conscious trend, a health-conscious way of thinking about the way we eat. But at the bottom line, we go towards the foods that are delicious and satisfy ourselves. I don't think there's any dearth of great steakhouses in the United States, and so sure, there shouldn't be any dearth of great Jewish delis. This food, yes, it may have a little fat in it, but if you don't eat it every day and you kind of maintain your gym membership, I think there's a way to balance things out.
Well, delis in American culture now may be fading, but in the 30s and 40s, they were considered very glamorous. There were, of course, many in the Lower East Side in the traditionally Jewish neighborhoods. But the Carnegie Deli, the Stage Deli in Midtown, the Theater District, where actors and comedians from Milton Berle to Shecky Green and the great Henny Youngman would eat. Let's hear just a clip from your film, Remembering Henny Youngman.
When Leo Stein had the Carnegie Deli, one of the best customers was Henny Youngman. When I say best customer, he never paid a penny.
When Henny went to the deli, he would ask me to come along with other people who were in the business maybe, And while he ordered food, he'd start telling jokes.
They loved him because he did shtick with everybody. Walking, he says, I want a table near a waiter. He did two jokes. He thought that was ample pay for his check.
He was the cheapest bastard in the history of the world.
Among those remembering Henny Youngman there, Jerry Stiller. People, listeners might recognize his voice. Jerry Stiller, longtime comedian, actor of Seinfeld fame. So that speaks to just a special personality, a special way of being, a character of a deli that you walk in there, something else is going on that isn't going on in your everyday restaurant. What do you think that is?
I think there is an absolute and essential difference between a quote-unquote typical restaurant and a deli. With the deli comes attitude. The attitude comes from a number of different sources. It comes from the succulence, the flavorfulness of the food. It comes from the countermen. It comes from that kind of that Max Asness, that Ziggy Gruber, that guy that's the greeter that makes you feel at home, but he's also giving you a little bit of guff at the same time. It comes from the customers that actually walk in there wanting to be punished a little bit. So this kind of very unique attitude at the Jewish deli belongs to the Jewish deli. It's one of the things that makes the restaurant so unique.
So times have clearly changed for the deli. Why the decline? Here's one opinion from your film.
This place, 30 years ago, was rocking. At 4 o'clock, there was a line out the door. And who were my best customers here? Jews. They were my best customers. Not religious Jews. Jews. They ate kosher food 5 days a week. On Saturday and Sunday, they ate Chinese food. That was a Jew. My mother. Those same people, they either died or moved to Florida.
Died or moved to Florida? Really, is that it? Why so many delis gone?
I think it's complicated, but in a nutshell, changing demographics, changing eating habits, changing neighborhoods, spiking food costs, and this idea that we kind of need to be reminded of the things that we cherish. You know, as the people that first started this business came here, they had nothing. They didn't start delis to become deli owner operators. They started the business to survive. You know, as Jews and other immigrant groups kind of became assimilated, attained a certain level of wealth, they left the old neighborhoods, and with leaving the old neighborhoods, they left some of the old tastes and traditions with them. So I think that it's unfortunate. You know, you cited the statistic that in New York alone, in the five boroughs, there are thousands of Jewish delis, kosher and non-kosher. Now I would say that number we quoted in the film, 150, probably down to 135. Mm-hmm. In Portland, Maine, the full belly deli several months ago kind of went belly up, no pun intended. So I think that we're kind of at a tipping point. I think the next 5 to 10 years will really tell us whether these old stanchion classic delis are going to make it. The more touristic ones, Katz's, you know, wonderful delicatessen. Obviously, Second Avenue delicatessen in New York, wonderful. The Carnegie, wonderful. But these little neighborhood stores are really imperiled because of economics, because of changing demographics, between rising food costs and between changing tastes. I think people have to be reminded about how good this food actually is.
Well, you also present some delicatessen operating on a kind of new model, at least incorporating some of the old food traditions with ideas of localism, for example. Why Sons in San Francisco, you know, they want to serve meat that's had a good life, as they say in the film. Zane Kaplansky in Toronto. Can those things coexist, do you think, Eric? The tradition and the new models of eating?
I think Ziggy might disagree with me, but that's okay. But I think the only way that delis are going to thrive and survive are going to be by marrying the old and the new. They have to stand side by side. So I think what Zane Kaplansky in Toronto is doing, I think what the Y Sons are doing in San Francisco, I think what Mile End, the Montreal Smoked Meat Kids are doing in New York, is absolutely fantastic. You have to reach out to a new demographic. If you are standing still, you're dying. So you have to keep up with the times, and you have to include a new clientele.
There's a new deli opening up in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. What kind of advice would you give to the owners of this new enterprise?
Be funny, hug your guests, and serve the best food that you possibly can. If you serve a great sandwich, people are going to be coming back. As Larry King said in the film, if he walks into a deli and the pastrami isn't fantastic, he will never, ever, ever, ever go into that deli again. If you serve great food, they will come.
Eric Greenberg, Anjou, thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure, and thank you. It's great to be in New Hampshire.
Eric Greenberg Anjou is the director and producer of Deli Man. It's a film playing at a matinee on Sunday at Red River Theater in Concord, and that's one of several theaters across the state participating in the Jewish Film Festival. Details on Deli Man and all of the films, you can find those on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety at the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 with more Word of Mouth right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray,
with help from our intern,
Katie McAuliffe.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.